Thank you, Darrell. Great pronunciation. And I take the opportunity to thank Professor Lackner and the IKGF for their welcome here and make our stay wonderful. And also a special thanks to Petra Ham and Esther Maria Guggenmos, who are making a great job here to arrange everything for the scholars, and you know about it. So today I will present the case of Liu Zehua, who was one of the 1,500 Chinese students who were sent to France as part of the Diligent Work and Frugal Study movement, known as Qingong Jianxue. It was between 1919 and 1921. I don't know if you know about it, but this movement is mainly known because some of these students would become later well-known leaders of the Chinese Communist Party, such as Zhou Enlai, Deng Xiaoping, and Cheng Yi. They were all students of this program. So in 1940, so many years later, you completed a PhD dissertation in Paris at La Sorbonne. You have a picture on the right, on the cosmology of the 8 trigrams and modern astronomy. So he stated in his dissertation that he discovered a 10th planet in the solar system, and he used both modern astronomy and the numerology of the Book of Changes, the I Ching. I will use the I Ching later. Famous French sinologist Henri Maspero was a member of the board of examiners, and he put this work in the line of Confucian scholars of the 17th century and later of the middle of the 19th century, who faced the challenge of Western science by claiming that it was already contained in the Chinese classics. So this case study is based on historical sources, but I also rely on fieldwork to show how his project met issues that were raised in the early 20th century, but that are still relevant today. These issues are about how traditional knowledge, such as the one based on the I Ching, fit or don't fit into the Western categories of science, religion, and superstition that were introduced in China at the beginning of the 20th century. I first learned about Liu Zehua in 2008 when I visited the historic site of Yoli. I don't know if you've been there already. It's near Anyang in Henan province. And it's famous because it is the place where the future King Wen of the Zhou, the founder of the Zhou dynasty, he had been imprisoned for 7 years. And tradition has it that it is during his stay in this prison that he invented the famous arrangement of Fuxi's 8 trigrams into a set of 64 hexagrams that are the core of the Book of Changes, of the I Ching. So you have some picture here. So this is the main gate here. This is outside the road leading to the site. And this is in front of the gates. You can see some fortune tellers that work here outside. He's also outside the historic site, another fortune teller office. Here you can see Swan Guoshi, like this, also in a fortune teller office. Another one here. And this statue is the one of King Wen. It's inside the site. And there's a kind of cult that is dedicated to Zhou Wen Wang, to King Wen. Here, for example, you have a small temple. You can, inside is the statue of King Wen, and you can see people praying and burning incenses. This is the statue of King Wen, and you can see here the famous diagrams from that derived from the I Ching. And here you have a picture of picturing Zhou Wen Wang, who is working on the milfoil to arrange the yin and yang and the trigrams into the 64 hexagrams. So this is where he's supposed to have invented them. And there's several exhibition halls. One is dedicated to the Confucian school, another one to the Taoist school. And there's also a hall dedicated to Fuxi with a statue, and a statue for each of the 8 trigrams. So we can see kind of cult to this trigram. So here we have an example, the Qian Zhi Shen, the spirit of the trigram heaven, and the one of the trigram earth. And yeah, this is a list of, it's another building. There's a list of very famous I Ching specialists where I found the name of Liu Zerhua. And you can see, here you can see the Song Scholar Zhuxi, so it's from the beginning of Chinese history. You can see the Song Scholar Zhuxi, and in the contemporary time you have Tang Mingbong, who is a famous issue specialist and also fortune teller. You can see Liu Dajun, that you know well from the Shandong University, Liu Zerhua, and here I put it for Xiao Weihua, who is also a very famous fortune teller nowadays. So they were all listed as I Ching specialists in this small museum. And also, I saw a French newspaper dating from 1940 that was describing Liu Zerhua's discovery, and that was what prompted me to explore his story and his legacy. I have some more pictures. You can see, still in this small exhibition hall, this is compasses from the three divinatory boards, the Qimen, Taiyi, and Yuzhen. And they also, like, this is milfoid, how you, an explanation of how you cast the I Ching hexagrams. And these are signs that say that there are some, I think one or two fortune tellers are working inside the historical site. And have you seen some of them were working outside too? So, I will go on with quickly on the historical and biographical background of Liu Zerhua, and then I will mainly analyze his argumentation in terms of analogical reasoning. And in the last part, I will describe his life in China when he came back to China in 1945. And I will see how his efforts to win recognition in China first came up against nationalist and communist anti-traditionalism, but were eventually integrated in the revival, in the cultural revival of the 1980s. So the biographical information about Liu mostly comes from a document that was published in 1919 to mark the centenary of his birth. I will give it to you if you want to have a look. And I also have an issue of a newspaper, it's named Famous Chinese. It's all dedicated to Liu Zerhua, so you can still have a look. So in this document, there is a story that provides an idealized portrait of Liu Zerhua as a man of humble origin who worked his way up to the position of scientist. Liu was born in 1899 in a poor peasant family in the village of Luodai, that is 20 kilometers east of Chengdu, so in Sichuan province. And when he was young, he resented being despised because of his poverty. And this convinced him that only education would allow him to improve his lot and that of his family. So his family struggled to send him to the preparatory school that had just opened in Chengdu at that time as part of the work-study program I told you in the beginning. So he won a scholarship to go to France, and he embarked to France in 1919. While in France, he experienced the harsh existence of the work-study students, but he also met the future leaders of the Chinese Communist Party, among whom Li Weihan, and later in China, he would reactivate this relationship with Li Weihan. So he changed jobs many times as a handyman or a worker in car factories, and at that time, the economic situation was very hard in France, and only foreigners were willing to work in such harsh conditions. And the Chinese also had to bear the insults of the other workers who called them filthy Chinese. So the conditions, as you see, were very difficult for the Chinese students. But at last, in 1932, he took part in a student competition, and he won a prize for his article, and it is during the presentation of this article that he was invited as a Chinese to speak about the I Ching. And indeed, he had already been confronted with the question of his French failures, and he had felt ashamed not to know anything about the I Ching and the culture of his own ancestor. So he had beginning to study the I Ching in France since the mid-20s. So what we can say briefly is that although he was involved in a movement that was inspired by the nationalist ideology and that also fueled the revolutionary ideals of the Chinese communists. But he considered himself as a representative of Confucian scholars. And according to this ideal model, a modest but virtuous man could rely on intense studying to pass the civil service examination and achieve a high-ranking official position. So in some ways, we can say that his aspirations seem to be in line with the reformist ideology conveyed by the work-study movement. For instance, his interest in modern science or his openness to foreign ideas, these were in line with the objective of the program. But in the end, there was still a deep discrepancy between his yearnings and the founding principles of the movement. One of them was that most of the Chinese students who went to France, although they considered frugality as a highly moral way of life, they were not concerned with the utopian combination of work and education that was the basis of this movement. And work was only viewed as a means of subsistence, and the students would rather study to their best to get out of the factories and never have to go back there. And mostly in opposition to the objective of the movement, that was to eliminate the traditional distinction between manual and mental labor. The contempt for manual labor was an important driving force in his personal history. So finally, although later the Chinese communist historiography praised the heroic attempt of the students to enter the laboring world, actually they retained elitist attitudes. And they resented being assimilated and mixed with the thousands of Chinese workers, the famous Hua Gong, who had been sent to France to take part to the war effort. So this desire to belong to the elite may explain why his experience of workers' lot of social injustice and even racism in France, this did not trigger any political involvement, although we can say that the environment was very favorable. And it was not on the contrary to the future communist leaders such as Deng Xiaoping or Zhou Enlai. Well, I will skip another. Yeah, there was the context in Europe at that time, the Orientalism, that was also influenced him, but I will skip this and came to his project that was, and how he discovered the planet through analogical reasoning. So his main objective was to show that the latest discoveries of Western modern science were consistent with the structure of the I Ching. So he wanted to provide a synthesis of the two methods to analyze any phenomenon. So he decided to apply his science, his bag of science, as he says, to the solar system. So he considered the cosmology that is described in the I Ching as the symbolic expression of the structure and changes that govern the universe. So he began to compare it with Western, at that time, with the Western knowledge on the solar system. But in 1930, Pluto was discovered, and this changed all his plans, all his calculations. He had to redo it again, but this put him on the track of a 10th planet. At that time, we have to know that astronomers from all over the world were competing to discover new planets, and Liu was eager to expose his theory to the scientific community. So that's why he enrolled in a PhD program at the University of Paris in 1937. So he, as I said, he aimed at bringing together modern astronomy and what he called the cosmology of Bagua. He called this traditional Chinese science that consisted of four steps. So the first step is to match the eight trigrams with the observed phenomenon through various analogies. The second step is to apply the features and the rules that govern the eight trigrams to the studied phenomenon. The third step is to confirm the results using the data of modern science. And then the fourth step, to deduce the characteristics of this phenomenon and explain how it operates. I will come back to these four steps later. So in the first chapter of his dissertation, Liu Zhihua explained the concepts and principles of the science of Bagua. So this science analyzes all possible arrangements between two principles, negative yin and positive yang. And their interactions are at the basis of all physical phenomena. So he writes, each gua represents a phenomenon, a character, an organism, a color, etc. The meaning of gua can perfectly be extended and developed. One only has to make correct interpretations when generalizing the text of the I Ching. So when you want to combine a trigram with a phenomenon, it requires an interpretation, and that must be guided by two principles. The first one, he calls it gua multiformism. That means that gua have a broader meaning than the phenomena they represent. So therefore, when you want to match a gua with a phenomenon, you have to select the features of the gua that correspond to the situation. And he adds, this choice is particularly difficult when it comes to forecast or deduction. This is one of the reasons why the science of bagua is easier in verification. And this also explains why one can get different conclusions using the same gua, although only one is right. So this is the first principle, and the second one is called gua interdependence. When you want to determine the characteristics of a gua, it's not enough to look at its configuration. One must also take into account all the processes that led to its formation. It follows that gua are not independent because they all have the same origin. Therefore, one must determine each time the process which corresponds to the case in question. So that is the basic principle of this science of bagua. And let's come back now to the four steps. So the first one is to match the eight trigrams with the phenomenon you want to study. So, as I said, you wanted to establish a correspondence between the planets of the solar system and the trigrams. And he did this in three steps. First, he matched the planet of Chinese ancient astronomy with Western modern planets by comparing their orbital period. Thus, he associates the seven regulators to the Sun, the Moon, Jupiter, Mars, Saturn, Mercury, and Venus. And he associates the planets of the four corners to Pluto, Uranus, Neptune, and an unknown planet, and a planet that is not yet discovered. So in the second step, he matches the Chinese planet with the trigrams. So he used the eight basic trigrams, and he added some of double gua, the hexagrams. And he did this by linking the properties of the planets and the features of the gua as they are described in the I Ching. I have an example of this kind of association. He writes, for example, let's first deal with the seven regulators and the Earth. There are exactly eight elements. One immediately has the idea to make them correspond with the eight simple gua. Moreover, the I Ching directly points at the gua which correspond to the Sun, the Moon, and the Earth. So we already know which one are the Sun, the Moon, and the Earth. Thus, we only have five elements left. Let's take the example of gua 1. This gua represents heaven, the emperor, and summer season. And Saturn is the planet of the sun of heaven and of the yellow emperor, and is linked to the last summer months. So it's quite logical to associate gua 1 and Saturn. So that this is the kind of association he makes from the I Ching text. So lastly, through the medium of the Chinese planets, he can link the modern planets and the trigrams. So that is the first step of this science, of this bagua science. Then, and the second step is to apply the relations between the eight trigrams to the phenomenon. So he relied on a traditional association of gua by pairs, so the gua are associated by in couples. And with this, he constructed six couples of planets. And one couple is made by Uranus and the unknown planet. But you might say this may be his imagination. That, so he has to prove this association, these couples, using the data of modern science. That is to confirm the results with the data of modern science. So this is an example of this chart you can you find in his dissertation. So he provided quantitative evidence to support this arrangement by couples. You can see here, for instance, all the data of the data of the, all the planets, and here the data of the this unknown planet that are still to be discovered. So by arranging also these mathematic ratios, he established a numerical constant. He discovered that the sum of the rotation speed of the planet he associated was constant. So you can see that he have built a system of equations with a single unknown, and that allows him to calculate the rotation speed of the new planet. This is the fourth step. And he followed a similar pattern to determine the density and the distance of the new planets. And he named this planet Proserpina after the daughter of Jupiter in the Roman mythology. So basically his idea is to build this system of equation with a single unknown, and then he could use the astronomic data to calculate the different data, distance, density, and rotation of the planet he's looking for. Well, what's interesting is to analyze the logic that underlay this endeavor to bring together Western and Chinese sciences. And since we know that Liu had to redo his calculations after the discovery of Pluto, we can imagine how he proceeded. He came up with the idea of a correspondence between the trigrams and the planets, and he juggled with the planet's physical data to find constant ratios that match his theoretical framework, even if it meant arranging the mathematical ratios, but also the symbolism of the trigrams. But then Pluto was discovered, and this created an imbalance in the number of planets. But this led him to on the track of a 10th planet to be discovered. So one can understand that from his point of view, the two sciences were complementary. To go beyond contingency, experimental data had to be part of a general law. That means that without the Bagua theory, the mathematical constants he highlighted were quite approximative, and this would have appeared as a result of change or bias manipulation. And conversely, the general Bagua theory is so speculative that it has to be validated by experimental data of modern science. That is to say that in the language of astronomy of that time, to discover a planet meant to express its rotation speed, density, and distance in mathematical terms. So Liu had to confront the Bagua science with astronomy. So we have here a striking example of analogical reasoning that is also called correlative thinking by Joseph Needham. But here I use the expression that was used by Alexei Volkov in an article. And this can be defined as simply as A is to keep A, whereas B is to keep B. So Volkov suggests a useful analysis in terms of mapping. So this analogical reasoning depicts a source domain, here in our case it's the Bagua, and a target domain, here it's the solar system. And each domain is constituted of related objects or facts with certain properties. And the mapping operation is an attempt to check the facts that are alleged in the target domain with the facts that are established in the source domain. And the characteristic of this type of reasoning are particularly relevant to Liu's demonstrations. First, the mapping process does not only match, it actually builds the correspondence between the two domains. And here I can cite Alexei Volkov. He writes, "The attempt to map the object from the source domain will imply either a check in the target domain or a process to find or construct such elements in the target domain to serve as images. So one finally can understand how difficult it must have been for you, because he didn't have any arrangement of trigrams beforehand, because so many possibilities exist actually. And he had to look simultaneously in both domains for an arrangement of trigrams that justified some numerical constants between the some numerical relations between the planets. This is what Volkov calls a constructive proof. This is to find or construct an object in a domain so that its properties or relations are verified in another. And this can explain why, as you put it, the science of Bagra is easier in verification. There's another characteristic of this type of reasoning is that it has a strong symbolic resonance. The mapping process makes the source domain become symbolic. That means that all of its properties must be kept in mind when dealing with the target domain. And again, this is what you expressed when he through the principle of Guo interdependence. And lastly, another interesting characteristic is that this mode of reasoning can be applied to different levels. The first level is to demonstrate the existence of a new planet. And there's also a second level. It's to prove the scientific nature of the science of Bagua. In this kind of demonstration, analogy is at the same time a mode and a result of argumentation. And this suggests that the demonstration has several purposes. Indeed, when Liu claimed that the trigrams were to Chinese science what numbers were to modern science, he actually sought to extend the scientific properties of modern science to Chinese science. And beyond his discovery, he wished to prove that the Chinese logic was not inferior to Western logic. And we can say that in the tradition of Joseph Needham, that he wanted to demonstrate the value of Chinese traditional science. But however, we can say that his project is somehow artificial, because he brought together two modes of reasoning that are embedded in different cultural contexts. And mainly, this clumsy combination actually revealed his misunderstanding of modern science and Westerners' poor understanding of analogical reasoning. Because on the one hand, Liu Zhewa reduced modern science to mere mathematical calculations. And it appears like kind of Western mania, like we have to comply to gain recognition. And for instance, while he had already discovered the similarity between the cosmology of Bagua and the solar system, but he writes that he had to keep calculating because he knew that the Western science cannot do without data. As one of their saying goes, without numbers, there is no science. But on the other hand, he introduced the French reader and at that time, a kind of Chinese science that did not draw its legitimacy from accurate measurements, nor from testable hypotheses, but from mere formal connections, correct generalizations, and proper interpretation of the aging. So this science for the French reader may seem like a rhetorical device that is disguised as a mode of proof. However, beyond this mode of reasoning, this work also incites us to explore the historical process through which the I Ching has become a source of scientific knowledge. So we can wonder how Liu obtained a PhD degree from the board of examiners of that time, among whom was the famous sinologist Henri Maspero. Picture of him. Not very bad. He was not a nice guy. If you read his reports, it's very bad for you. Well, so Liu actually he enrolled in history of science at the University of Paris, but he was under the supervision of a historian who was not a sinologist. So this historian asked advice to Maspero, and Maspero wrote a report which was very negative in the beginning. He writes, I will only read part of it. He writes, all translations are tendentious. Liu Zhewa does not only replace ancient Chinese philosophical terms by modern European scientific terms, which I can't blame him too much for, because after all, it is in the alleged equivalence of each other that lies the basic idea of his thesis. But even out of this process, the texts are always distorted to make them say what Mr. Liu wants to see and does not find. Yeah, it was very direct. Moreover, there is no criticism. Texts of every period are mingled regardless of their date. But as the theories of Mr. Liu take us back over 2,000 years before any writing document, this lack of criticism is less worrisome than the state of mind of an author who has been able to imagine and complete such a work. And he goes on, the state of mind of the author is the only interesting fact of the work. I'm glad he was not my supervisor. The author is a belated representative of a variety of scholars which flourished in China in the second half of the 19th century, but I thought was distinct among the younger generation, at least. The vanity of scholars consoled itself over the scientific inferiority of Chinese civilization, with the assertion that the whole Western science was already virtually included, but not exposed, in the I Ching, and that it is where we must look for it rather than in the school of European scholars. So Liu corrected some translation afterwards. He had in an introduction to explain his project, and Maspero wrote a second report in which he explained the reasons that led him to allow the, finally he allowed the dissertation defense. I have some extract here, where Maspero writes, there is indeed no doubt that at all times, a large number of Chinese scholars have believed that the sages of antiquity had possessed a superhuman science, and that all the Chinese and foreign discoveries of later centuries were already contained in principle in their writing, especially in the I Ching. This state of mind has been particularly strong in regard to astronomy since the Jesuits introduced the Ptolemaic astronomy in the 16th and 17th century, and it has reappeared strongly in the late 19th century to justify the adoption of Western sciences in public education in China. And it has thus been shown that in early antiquity, the Chinese had known electricity, steam, airships, airplanes, that they knew the earth revolved around the sun, etc. Well, he goes on like this, and I will lastly read this. It is perhaps even more curious that Mr. Liu, like most Chinese scholars, does not even realize that his work belongs to religious exegesis and Confucian apologetics, and not, as he believes, to positive science. So in the end, he accepted the defense. So that's what we can have now, his dissertation. So it's still a good thing for us. So his dissertation was, he defended his dissertation in 1940, and it was published in Paris in the same year. And some newspaper echoed the discovery, but it had little impact in the scientific community. I will go back to Maspero's comments, and because it shed light on the cross-cultural understanding of science and literature as it is embodied in the I Ching. So Maspero referred to the thesis that is known as the Chinese origin of Western science, known as Xi Shui Zhong Yuan. It developed in China in the 17th century in response to the introduction of Western science by the Jesuits. And according to this theory, Western knowledge, especially in mathematics and astronomy, originated in the Chinese classics, from which they were transmitted to the West. But whereas it developed and was gradually improved in the West, this knowledge got lost in China, and it came back to China in the shape of Western science. And this stimulated the rediscovery of Chinese ancient mathematics and also justified the study of Western science. And we can also say that Maspero's assessment, that was quite negative, as you have heard, it also reflected common European academic discourse on the I Ching at that time that was based mainly on late 19th century translation, notably by James Legg in the New United Kingdom. The translation was in 1882. And in France by Philastre and Charles de Arles. And these translators, and also although many scholars, showed little respect for the I Ching, for this classic. And one of them was named de la Couperie, a French one, had a low opinion of the Chinese commentators. He writes, their approach to analyzing the text is undeserving the attention of a man of common sense. It's a compilation of guesses and suggestions, a monument and nonsense. And he continues, he states that there are many educated Chinese who believe that electricity, steam power, astronomical laws were all to be found in the I Ching. We can also say indeed that in China itself, at that time, the classic had lost a great deal of prestige after the civil service examination was abolished in 1905. And the I Ching was more and more considered as a mere historical artifact, and his wisdom was of little use in the modernization of the country. So I will skip this and go on to note that we can see that the reception of the I Ching, of course, is strongly linked to the issue of translation. Because all translation, the first one by the Jesuits, the later one in the 19th century by European scholars, were guided by various motives, and they reflected the preoccupation of their time. And Liu's example also reveals that translation works as an additional layer in the correlative thinking or in the analogical reasoning I told you about. Because translation allows the translator to virtually build the equivalence he wants to build, and thus to demonstrate easily what he wants to demonstrate. For instance, Liu linked the trigrams and the planets by matching the concept of the I Ching with the modern scientific concepts. And this is what Maspero think is tendentious. This is a question of how you translate the terms, the Chinese term and the Western terms. So translation has also been important in the reception of I Ching, of course. And we can note that in 1924, the famous translation by Richard Willem changed the destiny of the I Ching in the Western world. As I just told you, it was not very considered by the scholars at that time. But this translation changed everything with its famous introduction by Jung. And the book enjoyed great popularity from the 50s onwards, when it was gradually translated into European languages. And it paved the way to a global craze in the 60s and the 70s, as you all know, when this classic became a source of inspiration in the fields of psychology, self-development, and countercultural spiritualities and art, mainly in the States, but also in Europe. And Liu's dissertation was even republished in France in 1980 by a Librairie de Médicis. It's a publishing house that had published the first French version of Willem's translation in 1968. And even today, we can see that Liu Zhiwa's approach to the I Ching still arouses interest in the Western world. And many authors follow the same logic to relate the I Ching with various scientific concepts or spiritual doctrines. You can see, for example, books on the I Ching and the DNA and how the two of them are related. This is one example, but there are many of them. But unfortunately for Liu, he was back in China at that time, and his future was not very bright in China, because he was not prepared with the difficulties that he will encounter in China, because his commitment to the Confucian ideal and to the I Ching was in blatant contradiction with both the nationalist ideology and later the Communist Revolution. So I will now go to the Chinese years and the time of controversies. So Liu Zhihua came back in China in 1945. He landed in Chongqing in Sichuan aboard a US military aircraft. When he arrived, he met Zhang Daofan, who was then a senior official at the Ministry of Education, and he was also a former student of the work study movement, so that's why he knew him. So this official helped him to find a job, but when he asked Liu to join, but he asked Liu to join the Kuomintang, so you have to be affiliated to the Kuomintang to have this job. But Liu refused because he says that he devoted all his heart to science and refused to eat the rice of politics, the Chinese expression. But he faced great difficulties, and as he said, this was not unrelated to the academic environment of the country at that time, and he particularly accused the intellectual of the modern trend, Xinpai Zhishe Fenzi, who rejected traditional Chinese culture as a whole, in particular in the field of technology, as he said. So indeed, his work has been quite popular abroad, but when he came back in China, it was considered as heresy, yiduan xieshuo, or a mere joke. And to refute his work, the famous Chinese astronomer Zhang Yuzhi even writes an article entitled "Do You Know How Planets Are Discovered?" This was against the work of Liu Zihua. So later on, Liu Zihua began to translate his dissertation into Chinese because his aim was to publish it in China. But his situation got worse after 1949. He was labeled a dissident. So he resolved to contact Li Weihan, that was then a senior official and that he had known in France when he was younger. And Li Weihan appointed him counselor to the government of Sichuan province. But when Liu Zihua learned that the council was a political body, he rejected the offer three times, but eventually he accepted the position. And as himself came from a poor family and was outraged by social injustice, he quickly adopted the political views of the Communist Party. But before everything, he was a researcher. And as he attended the mandatory courses on Marxist materialism, he began to apply the cosmology of Bagua to the Marxist theories. So in the same process that he did for the solar system. But he was then accused of heterodoxy, Zuo Dao Pengmen, because at that time the eight trigrams were condemned as feudal superstition, Feng Jian Mi Xin, and despite as a vulgar trick that were used by fortune tellers. And later on, during the Cultural Revolution, he was accused, because of his former link with France, he was accused of being a secret agent in the service of foreign powers. And his work was denounced as the fake goods of an imposter. The Red Guard searched his home several times and destroyed valuable documents. So the story in the document that I gave you, it depicts how he tried to fit in with the new ideology, with the new communist ideology. But in the end, he could not give up the traditional social codes. And his three refusal of the counselor position reminds us of the scholar officials that are described in the Romance of the Three Kingdoms, whose their prestige depended on how many times the prince had to beg them before they agreed to work for him. Well, however, it seems that the time of all Confucian scholars was definitely over. But still, at the end of the 70s, the intellectual categories that were inherited from the nationalist and communist ideologies were gradually questioned, and this would allow some old issues to be expressed under new forms. So from 1978 onwards, there were more and more publications on Liu Zihua, and up to several dozen in the 2000s. And there were various controversies that shed light on the different networks that involved Liu's work. For instance, during the cultural fever, intellectuals questioned the nature of Chinese culture and how and its role in the modernization of the country. So Liu's work was used to support the most opposed theses about either the specificity of Chinese culture or about its responsibility in China's backwardness. And in 1978, there was the so-called Science Spring that was launched by Deng Xiaoping. And on this occasion, Liu Zehua wrote an article in which he predicted that Proserpina, the planet he discovered, would be observed in 1982. And this revived the controversy. He was then confronted with new kinds of accusations, mainly pseudoscience, Wei Ke Xue, or spiritual pollution in the 80s. To Liu sought support from retired academics and local officials. And mainly in 1987, a retired general named Zhang Zhenhuan donated 3,000 yuan to help him publish his dissertation in Chinese and also to preserve his academic work. And this, we can say that this foreshadowed the preservation of his heritage that would take place later in the 1990s. Well, in 1989, his dissertation was finally published in Chinese, and Liu sent a copy to Joseph Needham at the Needham Research Institute. This is the answer of Joseph Needham. And in the foreword of the Chinese edition, he emphasized that his work differed both from divination and from Yishui, from the I Ching studies. What we can say from that is that he mainly looked for official recognition, that meant academic recognition and beyond political recognition. But, however, different signs show that he was gradually integrated into other circles, and references to his work shifted from academic to extra-academic circles. And from the scientific field to the field of culture or popular practices such as divination. There was, for instance, an article on him in the Journal of Scientific Qigong, was the time of the Qigong fever. And whereas he used to refuse to be associated with Yishui, with the I Ching studies, in the end he took part in one of the first Yishui conferences that was held in post-Maoist China. And his work also drew the attention of the famous Yishui specialist I told you about before, Tong Mingbong, who was also well known as a fortune teller. Well, Liu died in 1992, and his wife and son created the Liu Zehua Research Association. And at that time, local gazetteers also published articles about him. And there's another interesting point is that in the 2000s, his work has been associated with another debate on the so-called popular science. So the defenders of popular science, known as Minjiang Ke Xue, gather around Song Zhenhai, who is a historian who was his retired now, historian of science at the Chinese Academy of Sciences. And he has been organizing academic conferences on the living in the universe since 1990, I think. And in these conferences, he invites academic researchers, but also extra-academic scientists, known as Minjiang Ke Xue Jia. They present their research on traditional Chinese culture, on the development of modern science, on the comparison between Western and Eastern culture. So this is one side of the debate, and the other side are the detractors of pseudoscience. They are represented by a US-based Chinese, Fang Zhouzi, that has been nicknamed the Science Cop. I don't know if you know about him. He regularly denounces scientific fraud and plagiarism in China, mainly on his website New Threads. And he has been attacking Song Zhenhai's conference since the 90s. So the link with Liu Zehua is that in 2005, Fang Zhouzi wrote an article in which he denounced flaws in Liu's theory, and he denied any connection between Proserpina and the dwarf planet that he named Eris that has been discovered by US researchers in 2003. So Liu Zehua had said at that time that this was Proserpina that he had predicted. But Feng Zhouzi wrote this article to say that there is no link at all. So Liu's wife and son sued Feng for libel, as well as other newspaper. One of them, the Beijing Kejiba, had ranked Liu's prediction among what they called the 2005 10 greatest scientific frauds in China. And in this case, Song Zhenhai stood up for Liu's cause, and he organized a one-day conference in his honor at the Institute of the History of Natural Sciences in Beijing. And moreover, he organized a petition that was linked to, that was in response to the accusation of pseudoscience towards Liu, but also to attacks against the teaching of Chinese medicine at university. So he launched a petition to ask for the withdrawal of the word pseudoscience from the law for the popularization of science, known as Kupufa. So that if we put pseudoscience out of this law, it would not be used to denigrate Chinese traditional culture anymore. So later in 2010, I went to Chengdu, and I met Liu's son, who has been working for the last 20 years to promote the heritage of his father, and who created the research institute in 1922, when his father died. So he was very kind, and he brought me to visit Liu's birthplace, that is the town of Luodai, is east of Chengdu. And Luodai is now a touristic site as the oldest Hakka city in Western China. And Liu was indeed of Hakka origin. And he's exhibited at the Hakka Museum in Luodai. You can see here some pictures of him. You have here, this is the document I gave you, is here, and this is the Chinese edition of his dissertation. And so this is all the famous Hakka people, and you can find also Zhuge or Deng Xiaoping that were of Hakka origin too. Then later we also went to the cemetery where he is buried. That is in the Longchuan Mountains that are very well known for their feng shui. It is called the Changsongsi Cemetery. I have a picture here. So you can see this pavilion has been built by his son, and this is a bust of Liu Zera. This is the grave, and you can see his name is here. And on the left side, this is the cover of his dissertation in the Chinese edition, and this is the cover in the French edition. And there's also another particularity that shows the sanctity of his writings. You can see it's in the document I gave you. I don't have the picture here. It was during the funeral procession. Usually the people hold the picture of the deceased. So they hold the picture of the deceased and also his dissertation in the Chinese edition. You can see the picture. I think it's in the end. Well, so his son actually puts a lot of energy and a lot of financial means to perpetuate the memory of his father. Well, it's also because he works in real estate, so he's quite rich. But he's also shown that a kind of concern of a new economic elite that wants to gain a greater legitimacy by acquiring kind of cultural capital that he feels deprived of. And his commitment can be compared with the craze for the Guoshui, the national studies all know about, and about these classes that are organized by various institutes and that are made for an audience of businessmen who want to learn about the history of China or about the classics. So I will now come to the conclusion. Time for the question. And we can say that his story put forward the role of analogy in intellectual and cultural assimilation. We can say that it's quite a weak mode of proof, but it's a powerful teaching tool because it exemplifies and explains what is unknown through what is known. And that is also what is recognized as the educational virtue of rights, that is to transmit the laws and of the cosmos by reproducing them. Analogy also helps establish communication between antagonistic domains, and we can say that Liu was right to stress that his work would help people understand Chinese scholars' modes of reasoning. And mostly it shows how the I Ching, above all, symbolizes the art of cultural assimilation that is so often celebrated in Chinese history. We can say that Liu synthesized modern science by expressing and interpreting it in terms of the I Ching. And lastly, I will quote the analysis of a scholar, Thierry Menner, who studies the shaping of academic disciplines in China. And he states that he qualifies the view that academic disciplines in China have accepted science as their final standard. And he wrote, "Under the disguise of new names, Chinese traditional patterns were kept very much alive. Though academics used new terms borrowed from the West, yes, they reshaped them along the lines of traditional knowledge, sometimes even unconsciously." And in a postmodern context, as today, when we are aware of the historical character of modernity, it seems more difficult to assess if Liu presented a mere rhetorical manipulation or if his work can be considered as another explanatory scheme that is different from the one that modern science regards as legitimate. And I will stop here and thank you for your attention.